It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard is out today. Coming up here on Central Time, Wisconsin livestock, it's not just cows. We'll check out the state's sheep and wool industry as an annual festival kicks off today in Jefferson. First, Wisconsin got an extra helping of presidential campaign politics yesterday with Hillary Clinton visiting Milwaukee and Governor Scott Walker announcing a campaign reboot at Eureka College in Illinois. Walker's reboot comes after a month of backsliding in the polls following what some political observers called a lackluster performance at the first Republican debate. Yesterday, he said he intends to, quote, wreak havoc on Washington, end quote, starting on day one in office.
I'm here to announce today that we've got a plan to wreak havoc on Washington, and our plan starts on day one. And so my promise, thank you. And so my promise to all of you here and everybody else across America is every week, starting next week, we're going to lay out another one of our reforms, our big, bold reforms that we're going to do starting on day one. And next week, we're going to be on Monday in Las Vegas, and we're going to tell the American people what we're going to do when it comes to taking on the big government union bosses.
Hillary Clinton's visit to the state was part of the launch of her Women for Hillary initiative. Clinton has also been falling in the polls throughout the summer and is attempting to reassure supporters that her private email controversy won't sink her campaign. She took direct aim at Governor Walker.
Governor Walker thinks because he busts unions, starves universities, guts public education, demeans women, scapegoats teachers, nurses, and firefighters, he's some kind of tough guy on his motorcycle. Well, that is not leadership, folks. Leadership means fighting for the people you represent and putting their interests first.
Here with us now to talk about the two candidates is Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. Lily, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me today.
Let's first talk about the speech from Governor Walker, Eureka College. People have been calling this a reboot of sorts. So why would he need a reboot at this stage in the campaign?
Well, if anybody is looking at poll numbers, and there's a lot of discussion about how much poll numbers mean this far out from the caucuses and the primaries, Scott Walker had been climbing up in the polls in the spring, and then he's been falling off in the polls, particularly in the last month or two. And so there's some thinking with regard to both inside his campaign and among people who are sort of looking at his campaign from the outside, that in order to continue to be a viable contender and a top-tier candidate, Scott Walker is going to have to redo something with regard to his campaign in order to remain focused and in front of people.
And how much of this disruption to his campaign is Donald Trump-related? There's been a lot of talk about Trump making candidates talk about issues they weren't necessarily planning on talking about at this stage, maybe having to change the tone of their message. Is that an issue here for Governor Walker?
I think that Trump is certainly an issue for all of the candidates on the Republican side and to some degree the candidates on the Democratic side, although the impact for the Democrats is not quite as clear as it is for the 16 other contenders on the Republican side. Part of it is, you know, Donald Trump is not the sort of normal politician. The way he campaigns and to some degree what he says is a little bit sort of outside of what most politicians are used to hearing from their opponents, either within the party or outside of the party. And so, you know, Scott Walker, Jeb Bush, certainly some of the second-tier candidates like Rick Perry and Bobby Jindal and Rand Paul have all been trying to figure out how to campaign in the campaign with Trump.
Well, let's turn to Governor Walker's message at this speech. He says he wants to wreak havoc on Washington, referring, I think, largely to federal employee unions there. What was the message he was sending?
Well, I think he's trying to, again, get people to remember who he is, why he's of national importance, what he did in the state of Wisconsin, whether one likes it or is opposed to it. He's trying to make sure that people remember that he is the governor who took on the teachers' unions and some of the other the public sector unions in Wisconsin. And a lot of folks in the Republican Party were initially drawn to him 4 years ago because of that. And so I think he's trying to sort of draw some of that attention back to him and to sort of focus public attention on what he has done in the state of Wisconsin.
There had been attention to state employee unions before. This was an issue for Republicans here in Wisconsin before Scott Walker, so it seemed like that had resonance within his party. Is that going to be true at the federal level, do you think? Are a lot of people worried about the power of federal employee unions the way they might have been about Wisconsin employee unions?
Well, I think it's more difficult, and it's to some degree a more diffuse topic on the national level. Certainly the idea of unions, organized labor in context of sort of economic regulations and demands that unions make is a sort of a broad national issue. But specifically, federal employee unions is, again, you're sort of starting to parse the unions themselves then versus teachers' unions versus firefighters versus police. And it gets a little bit more diffuse and to some degree less of a broad focus on unions within an economic sort of message.
And the policies he's suggesting, as I've read, it might be hard for him on day one to make the changes that he's talking about because federal employee unions work differently than they previously did in Wisconsin.
Yes, and the federal government also operates somewhat differently than the state government does.
Talking to Lily Gorin, political scientist, about two big speeches with Wisconsin ties yesterday. We've been talking about Scott Walker making his speech a reboot to his candidacy at Ronald Reagan's alma mater. And Lily, let's turn now to Hillary Clinton. She came here to Wisconsin at a time when she's also going down some in the polls, still the leader on the Democratic side, but seeing some bad news there. Are those poll numbers changing what she's saying and how she's saying it?
Well, again, she's needing to respond in this context to a lot of the messaging that you see coming from Senator Bernie Sanders, which is more specifically targeted with regard to economic inequality as sort of the base of his political candidacy. And so she has to pay more attention to that because of the sort of popularity of the message that Sanders is carrying. And so while I don't necessarily think of Hillary Clinton as a populist candidate, her platform and her sort of political advocacy is now having to respond to, you know, where she's feeling the pressure within the Democratic primary.
And this was part of a Women for Hillary initiative. There was some talk when she was running in a primary against Barack Obama that she didn't go out and maybe as energetically try to capture the female Democratic vote in the primary. Is this a different strategy this time around?
It's probably somewhat more focused in terms of learning from some of the mistakes that happened in the 2008 primary election. At the same time that Hillary Clinton has been, you know, a longtime advocate with regard to women's rights and you know, sort of protections of families and children, and so it may be a more precise focus than it was per se on women voters. But certainly her, you know, sort of her life in politics has often involved a lot of focus on women's issues.
Wisconsin, not an early primary state. So why Wisconsin? Why now? And maybe why Milwaukee for that matter?
Well, again, Wisconsin is not an early primary state, but Wisconsin is also a swing state in the national election. And so to some degree, it's also an effort to sort of galvanize voters in a variety of places. And for both Scott Walker and Hillary Clinton, Wisconsin neighboring Iowa and sort of getting voters excited in Wisconsin may have some engagement with Iowa if folks in Wisconsin go down there and advocate for the candidates and sort of communicate some of that advocacy.
And while there are 17 Republican candidates, she singled out just a few of them, including Governor Walker. He's not currently the leader there. Why single him out in this visit?
Well, she's in the state of Wisconsin. And again, sort of the Democratic candidates also are as perplexed as I think many of the rest of us as to who the Republican nominee will be. And so I think Hillary Clinton, as long as she's in the state of Wisconsin, is you know, not going to miss the opportunity necessarily to call out Scott Walker. But I'm not sure if they're completely sure who they're going to be running against if she is the nominee, who they're going to be running against next fall.
Now, we've been talking about Governor Walker and Hillary Clinton in the context of some decline in polls. I've seen some articles lately pointing out that often whoever's leading in primary polls in that August before the election year isn't the one who wins any or all of the primaries and caucuses. So as candidates see dipping numbers this time of year, do they get really worried? Is there usually a sense of panic at this point?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's sort of the form of the dipping numbers also. I'm sure you remember in 2012, we had many candidates who had various bubbles. And Rick Perry was leading for a lot of the summer. Newt Gingrich went up and down twice, I think. Herman Cain was leading for a while. Michelle Bachmann was in the lead for a while. So the question sort of becomes, you know, sort of what not only is in the front in September, but is there staying power with regard to some of the candidates in terms of having stronger numbers or weaker numbers? And I think one of the difficulties that the Walker campaign is facing is he had quite strong numbers in the winter and the spring of this year, and then there's been a sort of consistent downturn in the last sort of 4 to 6 weeks, and that downturn, not even a plateau, but the downturn is I think probably somewhat worrying for the Walker campaign. The Clinton campaign doesn't have as many other candidates with which they're worried about at the moment, but they are, I think, concerned with regard to the Sanders candidacy and his consistent sort of rise in the polls. It's not, you know, sort of leapfrogging the way that sort of Trump has been doing, but it's a sort of a constancy that they can't dismiss as kind of a flash in the pan.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University, talking about Hillary Clinton's visit to Wisconsin yesterday and Governor Walker's campaign reboot at a speech in Illinois. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Food Friday, we'll talk all things breakfast with the host of the food-centric podcast, The Sporkful. First, when I say Wisconsin and livestock, there's a good chance that an image of a cow is going to pop anybody's mind, but Wisconsin's also home to a lot of sheep operations, and they are taking center stage at the Wisconsin Sheep and Wool Festival starting today in Jefferson at the Jefferson Fair Park. Dave Thomas joins us now from that fair. He's a professor of sheep management and genetics at the UW-Madison Department of Animal Sciences. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Well, comparing us with other states, we know we're up there with cows and cow dairy. Where does Wisconsin stack up when it comes to the sheep and the wool industry?
Well, the sheep industry in the U.S. is quite a bit smaller in general to the other livestock industries, but Wisconsin has about 2,600 individual farms that are raising sheep. That puts us in the top 10 in the country as far as sheep raisers, but we have fairly small flocks, and it's estimated that we have about 83,000 sheep in Wisconsin. That ranks us in about the top third of the U.S. as far as total sheep population.
And we're talking about small herds. How many sheep are we talking about on an individual farm?
Well, on average, it would be 25 to 30 sheep per farm, but we go all the way from some operations having three or four 4-H sheep all the way up to some operations that have 500, 600, 700 sheep in their flock.
Now, do we focus mostly on wool, milk, meat, or some combination of the three?
Yeah, that's interesting because I think most people, when they hear sheep, they immediately think of wool. Mm-hmm. And wool is one of the products produced from sheep, of course, but wool is a very minor commodity economically. Most of the money that comes into a commercial sheep operation comes from the sale of animals that are destined for meat. As an example, a sheep will shear about 8 pounds of wool in a year. And that wool, depending upon quality, might be worth anywhere from 50 cents to a dollar a pound. So you can see $4 to $8 worth of wool off of a sheep for keeping it entire year. So wool is surely not very important economically.
Is the sheep industry expanding here in Wisconsin?
We are not expanding, but we're holding our own. Our population numbers have stayed about the same over the past 10 years or so, And but in the U.S., we've had a general decrease in sheep numbers. So relative to many other states, we're doing fairly well. As an example, we peaked in sheep numbers in the U.S. back in the 1950s at about 50 million head, and today there are just something over 5 million head. So we've had a large drop in the U.S. sheep population over that fairly long period of time. But recently, Wisconsin has held its own as far as sheep numbers are concerned.
What accounts for that decline? Is there less interest in eating the meat from sheep or less demand for wool? Where is that coming from?
Well, I think there's no doubt that we are a cattle economy in the U.S. In the entire world, there are about the same number of sheep as there are cattle. But in the U.S., as I said, there's something over 5 million sheep, but we've got about 90 million cattle. So the palate of Americans is definitely towards beef and, of course, in more recent years, chicken. And we consume less than 1 pound of lamb per capita per year. But I think some of the reasons why our sheep population has decreased, one is predatory animals. Most of the sheep are raised in the western United States, and there are fairly large losses of animals each year to coyotes, wolves, bears. And many of the sheep graze on public lands, and it's been more and more difficult to find herders to take care of those sheep on the rangeland. So those are two main reasons for the decrease in the U.S. sheep population.
Talking to Dave Thomas from the UW-Madison Department of Animal Sciences about sheep, wool, and dairy here in Wisconsin with the kickoff of the Wisconsin Sheep and Wool Festival today in Jefferson. Dave, we haven't talked much about dairy. Now, I could see maybe where there's a growth in artisan cheese making and people looking for alternatives to cow milk-based cheeses. Is this something that's on the rise, sheep milk cheeses?
This is. Artisan cheeses, as you've said, have gained tremendous popularity in recent years in the U.S., and as part of that mix, we now have domestically produced goat milk cheeses and sheep milk cheeses. And I'm very proud of the fact that the University of Wisconsin has the only dairy sheep research program in the U.S., and we're actually milking about 300 sheep at the Spooner Ag Research Station up in northwest Wisconsin. That's operated by the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. And we have in Wisconsin a number of cheesemakers that are using sheep milk to produce some of these outstanding cheeses. And they continually win many awards at national competitions for their sheep milk cheese. So this is growing. It is very popular in the U.S. About half of the world exports of sheep milk cheeses from all countries in the world come to the U.S. So we feel that there's a tremendous amount of consumption in the U.S. that could be filled by increased domestic production.
Now, you mentioned predators. Are there other challenges unique to raising sheep, say, as opposed to cattle?
There are some. Internal parasites are much more of a problem in small ruminants, both goats and sheep, than they are in cattle. And that presents some special challenges to the sheep industry. And the fact that sheep are a minor species, many of the large companies that service other livestock industries aren't willing to put research dollars into developing products for the sheep industry since the market is so small. So that's another one of the challenges that the industry faces.
I know there are things like organic cattle, free-range chicken, that sort of thing. Are there comparable movements, efforts when it comes to sheep?
There are. And we just had a session here at the Wisconsin Sheep and Wool Festival this morning for beginning sheep producers, and a number of those people were entering the business as organic lamb producers. So there is a growing market for organic, natural-raised, pasture-raised lamb.
And you mentioned that UW Sheep Dairy Research. What kind of things are you looking at as we wrap up? What's the cutting edge of sheep dairy science and cheese production?
Well, one of the main things that we initially did was to import some dairy sheep breeds from Europe, for where they are commonly used, because we didn't have a dairy sheep industry in this country. And so we evaluated some of these European breeds, and they have spread then all across the U.S. and Canada. Some of that actually evaluation work went on to Spooner to show the increase. And then we're doing a lot of work currently with genetic improvement of the animals there, using some new genomic techniques, and then a number of more, I guess you'd say, mundane studies, but important studies looking at different nutrition diets to increase milk production and different management systems that will increase milk production.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Dave Thomas, Professor of Sheep Management and Genetics at the UW-Madison Department of Animal Sciences, talking to us from the Wisconsin Sheep and Wool Festival starting today in Jefferson. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert is out today. It's Food Friday time, and I think the song gave it away. It's time to join the Breakfast Club. The most important meal of the day can often be the most diverse and sometimes the most ignored. Breakfast can be as simple as a bagel or toast, as complex as a multi-course meal featuring poached eggs, fruit, waffles, and more. And as we learned yesterday on the show, a lot of people just skip it altogether. Joining us now to talk all things breakfast is Dan Pashman. He's host of the Sporkful Food Podcast at WNYC and the cooking channel's You're Eating It Wrong. He's the author of the book Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, speaking in general terms, are you a breakfast guy? Is breakfast an important part of our day?
Well, I actually recently cut back on my own breakfast consumption, and the studies on how important breakfast is are pretty mixed. You know, that old expression that you quoted at the top of the segment about how breakfast is the most important meal of the day actually traces back, it's interesting, it traces back to this guy, Edward Bernays, who was known as the father of modern public relations. He's sort of like one of the original ad men. And back in 1925, he was hired by the Beechnut Packing Company to help them sell more bacon. And Bernays, one of his classic tricks that he invented was the use of third-party authorities in advertising. So, like, you know the ads that say, you know, 4 out of 5 dentists mm-hmm. say this is the best toothpaste? That was Bernays. And he enlisted doctors, and he basically said, do you agree that a hearty breakfast is good for you? And they said, yeah, sure. And he said, do you agree that bacon is a hearty breakfast? And they said, yeah, sure. And pretty soon, and he went out with it, and he actually coined the term, saying that a hearty breakfast with bacon is the most important meal of the day. But a study out of Columbia last year showed that people who skipped breakfast actually lost weight more effectively than people who had a healthy breakfast, or both a healthy and unhealthy breakfast.
Well, I'll say, and I agree, I've heard that too, and I go minimalist with breakfast a lot of time, but it is Better Breakfast Month, I gather, in September, probably another advertising thing. And breakfast breakfast has the potential to be one of the most enjoyable meals of the day. Can I posit that to you?
Yes, you certainly can. And look, I'm certainly someone who advocates savoring every bite and making every bite that you take as delicious as possible. So I think that, you know, if society has determined that we can have 3 meals in a day, why would we want to have fewer than that? So, yes, I'm with you 100% on that.
And then there's, of course, the concept we can translate breakfast foods into other meals. They don't have to just be for breakfast anymore.
That's absolutely right, and vice versa. I think a lot of foods that are traditionally thought of as lunch or dinner foods can make for great breakfast foods. I love sushi or sashimi for breakfast. You know, if it's leftover sashimi, it's been in the fridge, take it out a little bit before you want to eat it so it's not quite so cold. It'll come closer to room temperature. That's a great breakfast. One of my favorite breakfasts in the world is peanut butter and jelly sandwich. It's a little sweet. You make a small one. It's not heavy. It's not going to weigh you down, but it's got peanut butter. It's got some fat and some protein. It's going to give you energy for the day. So I love a good PB&J in the morning.
Well, let's tackle the egg now. And that's one, I like it for breakfast. It's migrated elsewhere. You have sent us a recipe, a video, actually, of you making an egg and cheese, grilled cheese sandwich. I love egg and cheese sandwiches. I a lot of times do them with fried egg. They become very non-portable that way because it's like it's gloppy and messy, which I like. But what is the problem with the standard scrambled egg grilled cheese sandwich as you see it?
Well, you know, I mean, I love scrambled eggs. I love scrambled eggs in my egg and cheese sandwich. But when you make typical scrambled eggs, they're kind of light and fluffy. They're in little bits. And when you put them into the middle of the sandwich and you pick the sandwich up, the eggs fall out the back. It's a terrible tragedy that has befallen so many well-intentioned eaters. And so what I recommend is that you take your scrambled eggs, pour them into the pan, and as they cook, rather than scrambling them continuously and mixing them around, you form them into a patty that's the same size and shape as a slice of the bread you're going to be using, and cook it on both sides and then remove that patty. Then essentially cook a grilled cheese sandwich, open-faced. You know, the two, both sides open. Before you seal it up, you stick the egg in the middle. And then you get golden brown, buttery, crispy bread on the outside, melted cheese on top and bottom, which is delicious and also fuses the whole structure together. And it's cohesive. It will hold together through the bite. Mm.
And the key at watching your video, the key is you got the spatula. You're constantly like smooshing the egg back into that rectangle shape and then ultimately flipping it. The egg ends up denser. It's like between a scrambled egg and an omelet when you're done, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, you do get a slightly firmer, denser type of egg with this approach. It increases what I call tooth sinkability, which I like. You know, I think a nice, light, fluffy scrambled egg has its place. But I do like a nice egg sandwich that I can stick my teeth into.
And this is, as I mentioned, my fried egg sandwich, non-portable, messy. Do you eat this on the way out the door or, you know, in the car or the walk to the bus or whatever, what have you?
I've done it everywhere. I've done it. I mean, the grilled egg and cheese is a great sort of late night snack. It's a great breakfast. You can take it out the door with you. I've done it in the parking lot of Giant Stadium before a football game. You make the egg patties in the pan the night before, and then just use the grill to heat the bread, melt the cheese, and reheat the egg patties. And you can do, you know, because the egg patties are so portable and so convenient. And so it's a great tailgate food, too.
So you could, in Wisconsin, do that and add a brat to it.
Absolutely. Slice the brat up. Mm-hmm. You might want to parboil your brat the night before. Mm-hmm. And that way you can throw them on the grill. They'll cook a little bit faster. They'll be ready to go and slice them up, put them right into your sandwich.
We are reinventing breakfast with Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful Food Podcast, a very hard-to-say podcast eventually. evidently, it's at WNYC. He's the author of the book. Hold on. You're on the cooking channels. You're eating it wrong. And so let's get into another breakfast classic, the oatmeal, Dan. Now, I think of oatmeal as a really boring food, but on a show I used to work on, we invited listeners to share their unique oatmeal recipes. It was the most popular thing we ever did. Everybody has their unique oatmeal tip. So talk us through. You sent us a baked oatmeal recipe. It's up on the Central Time website. Tell us about it.
That's a great baked oatmeal recipe. My wife makes that all the time. It's from Epicurious. It's really delicious. And it's so, so simple to make. You throw the ingredients together, bake it up. It's a great thing to make for brunch. You can cook it in advance when you're having people over and serve it at room temperature. It's filling. It's a little sweet, but not overly sweet. I don't like super sweet things, especially in the morning, because I find like I get, you know, a big sugar rush and then I get a sugar crash, and by like noon I'm ready to go to sleep. So, and the baked oatmeal dish, you can throw nuts in. You can throw whatever fruit you have in your fridge or your freezer in. And that's really, I think, what makes oatmeal so great is that it's hearty, but it's really, you know, it's to an extent, it's sort of a blank canvas. And I think that while I love a good sweet oatmeal with whatever fruits and nuts and sweeteners, honey, maple syrup that you have lying around, so much great maple syrup to be had in Wisconsin, but I think that savory oatmeals are an underutilized, underexplored territory. Oatmeal with a little Parmesan cheese and pesto and sun-dried tomato can be delicious. Oatmeal, you know, in the afternoon after you've been outside on a crisp fall day and you come in and the sun's setting and maybe you pour yourself a nice beer and you make some savory oatmeal that's sort of hot and salty, sort of more like a porridge. I think that can be so restorative.
So if I think of this as porridge, I'm going to be more happy to eat it savory than with the sweet stuff. I'm kind of shaking my head at the concept of oatmeal with Parmesan and pesto.
Right. It definitely is a record scratch kind of a thing. You're like, what? But it works. I mean, oatmeal is just, it's mostly just oats. I mean, that, you know, oats can find their ways into many different foods. It's sweet and savory. So, you know, I think that's one thing I would encourage people with breakfast in general is just to, I really object to a lot to the very narrow definitions of breakfast that you see out there, and there's so many different possibilities. Some people just don't have a big sweet tooth, and so they find themselves, you know, they don't love carbs, they don't love sweets, so they feel like there's no good breakfast for them. But I think there's so many great options with savory breakfast, too.
Right, and following up your point, you've mentioned the sushi for breakfast or whatever. I've heard that it's really, maybe not uniquely, but almost uniquely American to have this separate category. These foods are for breakfast. These other foods are for other times of the day.
Right, absolutely. I mean, they, you know, in Vietnamese cuisine, the soup they have called pho, which is sort of a broth with meat and thin noodles, or rice noodles, which is an amazing concoction with beautiful herbs in it. That's commonly eaten for breakfast in Vietnam. And it's the kind of thing that, like, Vietnamese restaurants that sell that in the U.S. aren't even open in the morning, typically. So, yeah, and also spicy foods in other parts of the world are very common in the morning as they are throughout the day, less common in the U.S.
We're talking to Dan Pashman. He is the author of the book Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite Count. We are talking about breakfast, making it the best it can be, maybe some new ways to go about old favorites, or some unusual foods from an American standpoint to eat for breakfast. And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. What is your go-to breakfast? Do you have a tip on making a good, maybe quick, speedy, yet still delicious breakfast? And do you go out of bounds, eat non-breakfast foods at breakfast time? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got some waffle talk coming up after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday discussion now about all things breakfast with Dan Pashman. He's host of the Sporkful Food Podcast at WNYC and the author of Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. And we're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. What is your breakfast? What's your special treat, maybe on a weekend breakfast? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Mike is on the line in West Bend. Mike, hi.
Hey there, guys. Great show. Thanks for taking the call. Hey, you hit on something that I've been working on for a long time, and that's the breakfast sandwich. It's a difficult one to master, but from back from my old days as a McDonald's employee where they make that round egg, I took a little hint, especially great on a bagel. You take a lid of a mason jar and spray it with a little bit of oil, put it right in the pan and crack your egg right into it, or you can scramble them ahead of time and pour that right in, and it makes a perfectly round egg.
No, wait, you're talking the lid, or are you talking the screw-on thing for the lid, so it contains it in
Yeah, not the lid, on, not the flat part, right, the screw-on portion.
Oh, okay, and then you can flip the whole shebang there?
Absolutely.
And then, then it'll lift right off.
It lifts right off. You can also make a number of them and put parchment paper between them or wax paper and then freeze them for easy use to pull out and microwave in a pinch.
Brilliant. Wisconsin ingenuity at its finest. Thank Mike. Dan, you're using square bread, you know, toast or grilled cheese bread. This would be perfect, like he said, for a bagel.
Absolutely. And, I mean, you know, because you can form eggs into any shape. I mean, if you want to get your kids into this, you could get cookie cutters in different shapes, stars or hearts or dinosaurs or whatever they are, and use them in the same way that Mike said. Put them down in the pan, crack an egg inside there, and you'll have a dinosaur-shaped egg and get your kids excited about that. So I think there's a lot of fun you can have with eggs.
Mike, thanks for the call. We'll go to Dick in Algoma. Dick, you're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking the call. Breakfast is a really important meal at our house, and we do have fun with it. But we have our favorite egg. We have this square cast iron pan. It's small. It's about the size of a perfect size one piece of bread. And we throw the eggs in there, and we sprinkle everything on, and everybody adds what they want. It's awesome. That pan cooks from all four sides. It's an old cast iron square pan, and it's so much fun.
That sounds great. Dan, just having the right gear there can make a big difference.
Sure. If you get that cast iron going, I'll bet it adds a nice crisp, a nice texture. I'll bet you get the corner bites, you get the side bites, you get the softer, gooier center bites. A lot of great bites out of that cast iron pan.
And, Dick, what kind of things do you sprinkle on there? I mean, you talk like bits of ham or green peppers or what?
Yeah, we do it all. Everybody gets to make their own. Sriracha is a big thing. The kids like everything's right in the egg. It just turns out perfect.
And you only have one of these pans, though, so everybody's got to wait their turn.
Yeah, we haven't found another one, but we're looking.
All right, good luck with that. So patience, a virtue when it's make your own square eggs, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that. But it sounds like Dick and his family are getting so much pleasure. I think we got to get them some more cast iron pans.
Yeah, I wonder if anybody still makes those. That might be an antique store kind of thing. Thanks a lot for the call at 800-642-1234. Vince is with us next in Summers. Vince, hi.
Good afternoon. Great show. For several years now, I've been raising my own backyard chickens and enjoying their fresh eggs, especially in the morning. Any way you make it is just great because they're so tasty. And as an adult, I've learned in wintertime to love a fresh, over-easy egg on chili. I encourage everyone to try it on those dark, cold mornings.
And Vince, I got to ask, flavor-wise, eating it-wise, you notice a difference between, going to the grocery store and getting an egg versus that fresh egg?
Oh, yes. The taste is much different, as is the color. You'll notice a bright, bright orange. And for those people that like to put salt and pepper on their eggs, they can skip it because a farm fresh egg actually has flavor.
Vince, thanks a lot for the call. Dan, any thoughts on fresh eggs when you have access to them versus store-bought?
Oh, I think it makes a huge difference. I mean, I think that, look, there are some things that, paying top dollar for getting it from the farmer's market, I don't know in terms of the flavor, if it's worth it. Sometimes it can be very expensive, but to me, eggs are one of the ones that's worth it. I mean, it's almost like a different food when you're getting it. I mean, Vince has the best setup of all, but, even if it's at a farmer's market or just from a farm that might be near you, when they're fresh, the flavor, the color, the texture of it as well, because the yolk is firmer. It's just like a stronger egg, and that's super delicious. And putting an over-easy egg on top of chili is a great idea. Putting an over-easy egg on almost anything is a great idea. I've been on a real kick with something called shakshuka, which is a popular Middle Eastern dish. Super, super simple to make. You probably still get your hands on some good tomatoes around Wisconsin. Cook up some tomatoes in the pan, crush them all down, or even just throw tomato sauce from the jar into the pan, and then just crack the eggs right on top of the sauce as it simmers, and then throw the whole pan into the broiler for a couple minutes. The eggs cook, the egg whites kind of ooze into the tomato sauce and sort of meld together, and then you break the yolks into the tomatoes and give it a little kick in the sauce there. It's so good.
Yeah,
and so simple.
And any Mexican food plus egg over easy equals awesomeness.
Exactly.
We're talking to Dan Pashman, host of the Cooking Channel's You're Eating It Wrong, talking about breakfast. Before we get back to calls, Dan, I promised a little waffle talk. Can you give us a tip on making a better waffle?
Well, I think that if you really want to be hardcore about your waffles, the first thing, the most important thing is to make real waffle batter. Don't use pancake mix. And the second thing is getting back to, I think it was Dick who talked about the cast iron pan. A cast iron waffle press will make a huge difference in what you really want in a great, top 1% in the world waffle is textural contrast. You want the outside of the waffle to be crispy and the inside to be fluffy. And most run-of-the-mill, from-the-box pancake mix in a run-of-the-mill waffle maker will not get you the same level of contrast, and that's really where you get where the magic happens. I love waffles, and I love the structural integrity of them. I love the grooves. I think it's a very interesting question to ask, Rob. I don't know if you have a take on this, but I love to debate with people when you cut waffles. Do you cut down the spines of the waffle, or do you cut across the wells of the waffle?
You mean with my fork? Honestly, I'll level with you. A lot of times I just jab the whole thing and chew off of it, holding it up on the fork, kind of barbarian style.
Right, right. It's an interesting debate because, you know, the people who cut along the spines, they're trying to preserve the wells to hold butter and maple syrup. But I don't like to cut along the spines because I feel like the spines have the crisp. They have the texture. If you cut them in half, you're destroying that crisp. So I like to cut across the wells and then dip each bite of waffle into the syrup on a per-bite basis so that they don't turn soggy too quickly.
I want to get to one more caller. Samara is with us in Oshkosh. Samara, hi.
Hi, I'm laughing because I didn't realize anybody else had thought about these qualities of waffle before.
Not only have I thought about it, I managed to turn it into a career.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to mention the foods that we eat. I'm half Lebanese, and we have Lebanese breakfast foods that we eat. But we also, our family ritual on Sunday morning is to watch Sunday morning on CBS and to eat what we call floppy waffles, so they don't have that crispy outside and fluffy inside, even though those are wonderful. But ours is more like a crepe batter, and it's a recipe my mom got when we were living in Lebanon from a Belgian friend of hers, and it has a half cup of sugar in there, so they're very sweet already, and they're just, it's what we do. It's our family thing on Sundays.
That sounds fantastic, Samara. And Dan, we're going to give Samara the last word today. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Rob. Have a good weekend.
You too. That was Dan Pashman. He is the host of the Sporkful Food Podcast at WNYC. He hosts the cooking channels You're Eating It Wrong, and he's the author of Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite Count. You can keep sharing your breakfast favorites on the Central Time Facebook page, and we've got a recipe there from Dan for oatmeal, baked oatmeal, and then a video of that egg grilled cheese sandwich. He has solved the scrambled egg grilled cheese sandwich for us, so check it out while you're there.